You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, from Harry Potter to Frozen, movies made for kids bring joy to a wider audience than their children's label. We talk to a Wisconsin professor about their broad appeal and invite you to share your favorites. Now, we're looking at the Supreme Court's decision not to take on emoluments cases against former President Donald Trump. The Emoluments Clause of the Constitution prevents a federal office holder, including the president, from profiting from their government position. This clause is the reason that most presidents temporarily give up their financial stake in businesses while they're in office. Emoluments cases have rarely been considered in court because it's uncommon for presidents to keep active business interests when they're leading the country. Not so with President Trump. Various lawsuits accused him of profiting off his restaurants and businesses while in office, most notably the Trump Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. We're looking at why the Supreme Court rejected emoluments cases against Trump and what that could mean for the courts and for politicians in federal office moving forward. Juliet Sorensen is a clinical professor of law at Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law and the executive director of Injustice Watch. That's an organization that investigates institutional obstruction of justice and equality. She's also the co-author of Public Corruption and the Law, Cases and Materials. Juliet, thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was the argument for this decision to throw out emoluments cases against the former president?
Well, importantly, there was no justification offered along with the Supreme Court's decision. It was two brief orders in which the court dismissed rulings against President Trump in the two cases coming from the lower courts and dismissed them as moot. They were dismissed as moot because President Trump is no longer president of the United States, of course.
And with that move, though, because Trump is no longer in office and it's a moot point, that means there's no official Supreme Court interpretation of the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution. What should we glean from that?
The court has given us no guidance as to where it would go if an emoluments clause case reached it in the future. The court can only hear cases that are justiciable. That is to say, there has to be a live controversy before the court. And in this case, the emoluments clauses of the Constitution very clearly apply to, in one instance, the President of the United States, and in another instance, any federal officer of the United States. Since Donald Trump is no longer either one of those, the case is moot, and the Supreme Court literally does not have the power to hear it. So what does the future hold? Well, first of all, there would need to be another either president or officer of the United States, in the case of the Domestic Emoluments Clause, who allegedly violated it. Then there would need to be a lawsuit brought, and it would need to be litigated all the way up to the court. So a lot of hurdles and a lot of scenarios to be played out before the Supreme Court might ever have the opportunity to interpret the Emoluments Clause in the future.
There's a pretty clear parallel between that and what some lawmakers, including U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, have said about impeachment. They say that because the president is out of office, it doesn't make sense to impeach. What are the drawbacks of prosecuting a president who's no longer in office, whether it is through lawsuits or through impeachment?
The question of whether to proceed with a second trial of Donald Trump, he has already been impeached for a second time, really is not a legal question. It is more a question of politics and policy, which is really one for Congress's leaders to decide. I can see, however, the overlap, which is to say there is a certain sense that of what's the point? Isn't this all now moot? Shouldn't we collectively move on? The Democratic leadership apparently felt otherwise, at least enough to bring the article of impeachment in the House of Representatives.
So the argument may be the same, but we're dealing with a legal issue on one side, and you say the other is really more about politics.
Exactly.
We're talking with law professor Juliet Sorensen. She's Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law there. There's time for you to join our conversation here on Central Time. You can call 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Supreme Court's decision to reject foreign and domestic emoluments cases against former President Trump? Do you think that Trump violated the emoluments clause while in office? What do you think about the future if we do have to wait for another high-profile member of our government to be in this position? Give us a call. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You mentioned that there were no dissenting votes, and the court didn't comment on this decision to dismiss these cases. But lower courts in the past, they have gone after the former president on these allegations of violations of this clause. What were the arguments in favor of pursuing those cases while the president was in office?
Yes, you're right. Lower courts have ruled against the president, the former president, with regard to emoluments clause violations. There was a case brought in New York and there was a case brought in Maryland, and they were consolidated for the purposes of going up to the Supreme Court. The New York case was brought by competitors of Donald Trump's businesses that said that they had been disadvantaged by the payments that he had received while in the White House. Again, payments that improperly advantaged his private business interests, even though he was serving in public office at the time. The Maryland lawsuit accused President Trump of violating the Constitution, very specifically by profiting from his Washington hotel. The allegations were that he received these so-called emoluments, which you can think of as assets or benefits, in the form of money from foreign government, also from federal agencies and state governments that conducted business at that hotel, which I understand was doing a pretty brisk business during the years of the Trump administration, and why to curry favor with Donald Trump and his presidential administration.
We're taking calls at 800-642-1234, and Cindy in Appleton wants to join the conversation. Hi, Cindy.
Well, I just want to say how really disgusted I am about all this. I mean, this man has been a criminal all the while he was in the White House, not only with the emolument clause, but also with his insurrection and supporting all these hate groups. It just disturbs me that this man is going to walk away with no penalization of any kind.
Cindy, thanks for talking with us about that and sharing your perspective. I mean, Juliet, Trump did have conflicts of interest during his presidency. Why wasn't that fact enough to get these cases through court while they applied?
So specifically with regard to the emoluments clause, it was uncharted territory. It's almost never been litigated in the past. And I will say that courts in general are very cautious about circumscribing the president of the United States. But Cindy, I wouldn't give up hope completely if you hope that our former president sees a measure of accountability for his actions while in the White House. I do think that some efforts to hold him accountable for different actions will not be successful. That includes these court orders on the emoluments clause, and I think it most likely includes this latest effort to impeach and convict him. However, there are currently a number of other investigations, both criminal and ethical internal investigations, going on into his conduct and the conduct of his presidency.
We mentioned earlier that there is a separation between law in some circumstances and politics in others. Some people don't see it that way, and they're concerned that the courts will be political either way, whether those cases come out in favor of former President Donald Trump or against him. You know, as a legal expert, can you reassure us at all?
You know, I would say that many federal judges who became federal judges during Donald Trump's presidency have ruled against his efforts to throw out the results of the presidential election in November. The Supreme Court, as we know, contains multiple Trump appointees. They have ruled in an increasingly conservative fashion, which is exactly what I believe the president was hoping for. But not in a way that that signals to me that they're going to utterly pander to him as an individual. So I think that the so-called Article III judges, those federal judges with life tenure, they may have political ideologies, but they also have a respect for rule of law and due process. And I think they'll follow their nose where it takes them. Mm-hmm.
Juliet Sorensen stays with us. She's a clinical professor of law at the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this process? What concerns you about moving into the future? Or do you think that this makes sense and that it was the right decision, legal or political? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Join in now as we continue the conversation here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with legal expert Juliet Sorensen about the Supreme Court rejecting emoluments cases against former President Donald Trump. And we do want to hear from you. What questions do you have about these cases or the Supreme Court? Right now, you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And I want to welcome Jesse in Madison to our conversation. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind here?
So out of curiosity, as I was listening to this show, I'm wondering, so the Supreme Court is not going to hear the case due to the fact that the president is no longer in office. It seems odd to me because the Supreme Court can try cases for murder, which clearly are not, like the murderer is not in a state of murder at the time. So I'm just curious as to how that actually legally plays out. Why he couldn't be tried for crimes that he committed while he was in office.
Jesse, let me jump in here because it's a little bit hard to hear you, but we did get your question, and that is, why does the emoluments clause, why would they only be able to take the case if the president were in office? Juliet.
Yeah, thank you, Jesse. It's a great question. So the emoluments clauses state very clearly that they apply to an officer or a president. I see your point, because if the violation has already occurred, then that doesn't necessarily make it become undone. It doesn't mean that it didn't happen. To use your analogy to murder or a criminal prosecution, if an act is committed, the prosecution can follow. It's actually not the case, though, with a civil lawsuit. This is not a criminal case, but this is a civil lawsuit. And civil suits can be dismissed if there is no active controversy or case before the court. And that's the case here. It's in some sense, it's a technicality, but it's a technicality that, as you can imagine, every lawyer and every defendant sued in a civil case would want to use if it applies to them, because it makes your case go away and you're done with it.
Mm. Jesse, thanks for asking that question to clarify. We have another follow-up question from Rick in Waupaca. Hey, Rick.
Hello.
What are you thinking about? Hi.
I didn't quite understand. Was there a lower court ruling and then it ended up in the Supreme Court as an appeal? And if so, if the Supreme Court didn't have standing, why wouldn't the lower court ruling simply stand?
Rick, thanks for the question. Juliet, can you break that down for us?
Yes, thank you. So, yes. There were three lawsuits against President Trump alleging violations of the Emoluments Clause. One of those was dismissed in February, and the Supreme Court declined to hear that case. The other two went up on appeal to the federal courts of appeals in New York and Maryland, and the plaintiffs who sued President Trump won on appeal. Trump himself then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And by the time it reached the Supreme Court, he was no longer president and the court dismissed the cases as moot. So the Supreme Court therefore vacates all previous rulings in the cases below in the lower courts. And there is no definitive outcome to the lawsuit.
And Juliet, that's different than when the Supreme Court just declines to take a case and another court ruling stands as the actual answer.
That's correct. They didn't decline to take the case. They actually ruled on it and dismissed it.
Right. We are talking with law professor Juliet Sorensen, who's our guest. She's Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. She's with that law school. And we're talking about the context of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to stop lawsuits accusing former President Trump of profiting off of his public office. Let's talk more about the fact that the courts have been struggling with how to interpret the Emoluments Clause for years. The case brought by the Attorneys General of Maryland and D.C. was actually the first time in American history that a court ruled on the meaning of emoluments. And, you know, we saw them thrown out by court several times during Trump's tenure. So why is it so rare for courts to take up this particular clause?
The truth is that the fact that it's rare is a good thing. There's a scholar in this area who wrote a book on the Emoluments Clause called Ben Franklin's Snuffbox. And it has that funny title because Benjamin Franklin received a snuffbox from King Louis the 16th, if I'm remembering my Louis correctly, of France. That was deemed an improper violation of the Emoluments Clause. And that's really what the framers were getting at. You know, if you tour a museum in Europe and you see that sort of astounding array of jewels and valuable items that foreign heads of state would bring and give to these rulers, always seeking influence and currying favor, that's exactly what the framers were guarding against. But the truth is that there's a lot more than just the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution that tries to prevent this type of activity. We have pretty extensive ethical codes of conduct for our federal officials, not to mention our state and local officials, that cabin the type of gifts one can accept, the type of outside business practices or interests that one can engage in. And that is to avoid undue influence and also to avoid, you know, not just actual impropriety, but the appearance of impropriety, of being corrupted or influenced by that outside power.
I want to welcome Dave in Junction City to the conversation. Dave, what are you thinking about as we talk about the Emoluments Clause?
I'm just wondering, as far as like what it pertains to members of Congress, I mean, there's some anecdotal people who profit from their inside information and legislation going forward that might profit their portfolio. How does that affect what you're talking about?
Thanks for the question, Dave. It really sounds like a follow-up, Juliet, to what you were just talking about the clause applying to other public servants.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dave. So there are actually two sections in the Constitution that speak to what they call emoluments. And emoluments are really things of value. And it's the Foreign Emoluments Clause that would apply to those members of Congress. It prohibits the federal government generally and restricts members of the federal government from receiving gifts, emoluments. It's also sometimes called the Titles of Nobility Clause. Another country cannot knight a federal officer of the United States. I can't become Lady Juliet. You couldn't become Sir Dave in the United Kingdom. And the goal, again, is to protect against those so-called corrupting foreign influences. Could that apply to members of Congress? You bet.
Hmm. John from Tomahawk has one more question I think we can squeeze in here. Hey, John.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question would be, is it possible for anybody holding the office of presidents to maintain international business interest and conduct business while in the office of president without in some shape or manner violating the clause?
John, thanks for the hypothetical. Juliet, what do you think?
The cleanest and easiest route is not to be engaged in a side business. That keeps the public and the private separate. It prevents against that so-called appearance of impropriety as well as any actual impropriety. Now, that is different from the question of whether or not it's possible to engage in some side activity without violating the Emoluments Clause, which essentially, again, provides that an office holder shall not accept anything of value from a foreign state. Now, President Trump has maintained that his business interests have been strictly separate from his official acts and his time in office. These lawsuits sought to show otherwise. They sought to show that really it was impossible to separate them, and that the entire reason that his competitors were losing business to Trump Industries, and the entire reason that the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. was flourishing, was because people were seeking to influence him and get favorable treatment from him. Unfortunately, because of the Supreme Court's ruling, because that question is now moot, we'll have to wait to find that out for another day.
And that's true in courts. From your perspective, are you able to weigh in on whether it appears that Trump violated the Emoluments Clause?
Here's what I would have liked to have had happen. I would have liked these lawsuits to proceed, to engage in so-called pretrial discovery, where the plaintiffs have the right to access financial records, correspondence, emails, invoices, to see what the evidence would show. These lawsuits were dismissed prior to the plaintiffs having had that benefit. So it's too early to say. I am in favor of public officials being transparent and accountable. So I would have liked the cases to go forward. That said, I think that the Supreme Court's ruling, again, on a technicality, is correct here.
Mm-hmm. Juliet, thank you for walking us through all of this. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Juliet Sorensen is a clinical professor of law at the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law, and she's the executive director of Injustice Watch. That's an organization that investigates institutional obstruction of justice and equality. She's also the co-author of Public Corruption and the Law, Cases and Materials. Coming up, movies made for kids are enjoyed by many children, of course, but also adults watch them with or without the kids. We talk about the charm and comfort of watching these, and we're asking for your favorites. I'm Keeley Voltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Polls suggest most Americans believe immigration is a good thing for the country, but the system's broken. As one of his first acts as President, Joe Biden put forward a bill to change that. It immediately reignited the debate over who belongs in America. Hear the national conversation about the risks and rewards of getting an immigration deal done today on 1A Plus. It starts at 6 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret, and that is, of course, the unmistakable score to the movie Up. Kids entertainment, TV or movies, it's not just for kids. I'm sure you're not alone if you find yourself laughing or crying during an animated flick that's supposed to be for children. Again, we're talking about Up here. Here are a few of the movies that made Rolling Stone magazine's top 40 greatest animated movies ever. Rango, Coraline, The Incredibles, WALL-E, Spirited Away, Inside Out, Toy Story, and of course there's so many more. We're talking about it right now and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is a movie or show made for kids that you've really enjoyed watching, whether it's animated or not? Why do you like watching kids' movies as an adult? Hey, maybe you're a kid. Give us a call. Tell us what you like to watch with your family. 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael Newman is a media studies professor at UW-Milwaukee. He teaches courses on film and television. He's also the author of several books, including Video Revolutions on the History of a Medium. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thanks for being willing to talk with us about watching kids' movies as adults. I understand you have children yourself. Do you find yourself enjoying their media more often than you would expect to?
I enjoy it a lot, and it's been one of the pleasures of the pandemic times, to be honest, to look forward to watching movies and TV with them. It's something we do together. And as they grow up, and, you know, one's a teenager and one's 11, you know, I kind of lose some of the pleasures of watching those kids' movies with them. But I also just take pleasure from them myself as well. And I think that they're, you know, sometimes they're marketed for kids, but they're also marketed to families. And, you know, kids don't go to the movies by themselves these days very often. So they're made to be appealing to adults as well.
Oh, yeah. And I've got younger kids, elementary age kids, and movies have been a big thing. We're doing a little bit of like exploring new ones, but also trying to convince them to watch the ones that we liked growing up. Mm. So like it's this combination of taking in the new media, but also an opportunity to be a little nostalgic.
Oh, for sure. And that's a big part of their appeal. They kind of take us back to our own childhood, whether we remember them from our you know, older day, you know, our younger days or not. But I think there's also a kind of innocence that we can tap into, you know, easier times maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially when things are hard. Sometimes the movies can hit a little too close to home, poking some fun at very relatable adult issues. Let's take a listen to one of those classic kids movies. It's not new. Here is a clip from Toy Story that illustrates that.
Buzz, hey, Buzz, are you okay?
Gone! It's all gone. Oh, it's gone. Bye-bye. Woo, see ya.
What happened to you?
1 minute you're defending the whole galaxy. And suddenly, you find yourself sucking down Darjeeling with
Marie Antoinette and her little sister. I think you've had enough tea for today. Let's get you out of here, Buzz.
Don't you get it? You see the hat? I am Mrs. Nesbitt.
Snap out of it, Buzz!
I'm sorry. You're right. I am just a little depressed. That's all. I can get through this.
Oh, I'm a sham!
Shh, look at
Why,
me. I can't even fly out of a window.
That is, of course, Buzz Lightyear. Having a bit of a breakdown there. What works so well about taking some of these real human moments and then putting those on these tiny, colorful characters?
Yeah, I mean, these are such larger-than-life characters. And you know, I think maybe as an adult, I can appreciate how Tom Hanks and Tim Allen perform these roles. And I recognize their voices and know them from TV and movies also. You know, they're the toys coming to life, and that's such a kind of resonant fantasy that goes back a long way. And, you know, those movies over the several of them that have come out over the years have, I think, brought some of that magical childhood play experience to the screen so vividly.
So there's an element of escapism to this?
I think so. They're so heartwarming, too. You know, I think the one I watched most recently was Toy Story 3, where the, you know, the kid grows up and doesn't need his toys anymore. And, you know, it's kind of sad and touching and true all at once. And the adults who watch with their kids can identify with that for sure.
Yeah, not just as yourself, but also watching your kids or your grandkids or your nieces and nephews love something so much and then just no longer need it. There's certainly a different perspective there. We've got Searle in Madison on the line who wants to talk with us about this. Hi, Searle.
Hello. Yeah, I was just thinking about all the movies that I've seen with and without my kids over the last 20 and 30 years or more. We used to buy movies before we had kids.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that, especially in the last 30 years, so many of these animated films, especially the Pixar style of movies, it's almost like they have so much between the lines innuendo, specifically targeting the parents or the adult viewer, and that it seems like the movie is for the adults, that they can bring their kids along.
Yeah. Searle, thanks for that perspective. Michael Newman, these movies are walking a fine line if they're trying to appeal to both kids and their parents watching.
I think that there's a really great technique of having some jokes that will go over the head of the typical kid, but they won't mind. They won't know that that's going on. And kind of gives a pleasure to the parents to catch a reference, to get a joke. And it, it's kind of the something for everyone approach. So the kids might like the physical humor, the bathroom humor, that kind of thing. And the adults like the references, or like I said, recognizing the actors who voice the characters in an animated kind of cartoony movie. You know, some of my favorite examples from my own childhood that I still love are the Muppets or Sesame Street, where there would be guest stars on the Muppet show or in the Muppet movie, or parodies. You know, parody is such a big thing in children's media, and the children just never know what's being parodied. I watched an episode of The Simpsons a few weeks ago with my kid, and it was a parody of Evita, the musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber. And it was a hilarious episode, and my son has never heard any of that music or doesn't know the story of Eva Perón, obviously. It has no meaning to him, but it was hilarious to me, and yet we both really liked it. So I think that working on multiple levels can be a way that enriches everyone's experience.
We're talking with Michael Newman, who teaches courses on film and television at UW-Milwaukee. He's also written books. And there's a line for you now at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite movie? What was it as a kid? Do you watch it now? As an adult, what movies that are kind of targeted toward a kid audience have you really enjoyed? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's what Matt in Alloway has done. Hey, Matt.
How are you doing? One of the things I love about animated films is the amount of Easter eggs that you can find in those films. And as an example, if you're watching and you look in the background, you sometimes see things in, like, in Shrek 2, there's a moment where there's this giant gingerbread man who's attacking the small village, just like Godzilla. He goes for a Starbucks and he grabs the giant Starbucks coffee cup. And when he does, what you see that, but if you look on the other side of the screen, there's all the people rushing out of the Starbucks into another Starbucks across the street.
Matt, thank you for sharing that example of really what we're talking about here, Michael, with some of that adult humor or understanding, seeing our lives in these characters that are animated.
Yeah, for sure. And I think they are over time cramming more jokes in, like, that are in the background, those kind of blinker you'll miss it things. I don't think you see those in the Disney movies from the 50s as much as you do the more contemporary examples.
And I'll say, sometimes you really have to look, because there are lots of movies that I have heard because I'm doing other things while they're playing. And then I get around to watching them after I'm familiar with what the story is from hearing it. And there's so much more to the story when you're able to watch it and listen to it, especially as an adult. You can really pick up on more things there. So it's not just jokes that are written, but it's also what the animators are doing. Is that what you see, too?
Yeah, for sure. And I think if these movies are well made and they have, you know, impressive visuals and, you know, songs and lots of appeals, then watching them more than once and watching them at different ages, it'll in some ways be like watching a new movie, because you'll find some things that are familiar and some things that you hadn't paid attention to. Just to return to the Muppets, the Muppet movie has tons of cameos by these actors who I just wouldn't have recognized as a kid. Like Bob Hope or someone like that. And now as an adult, I recognize them all. And you know, I get a kind of jolt of pleasure just for knowing who they are and what kind of goofy role they put them into. And that's a pretty old movie now, from the 70s.
Yeah, we're talking with Michael Newman. He teaches courses on film and TV as a media studies professor at UW-Milwaukee. He stays with us for this conversation. You can let us know what your favorite movie is, or have you watched some new-to-you kids' movies lately that you think we should see? Go ahead and send us a message at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Join in now here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network.
Here's a Muppet News Flash! Puppet Labs has announced the escape of their new electric sledgehammer, which is believed to be roaming the city on a very long extension cord. There is no need to panic, however, since the hammer only attacks really wimpy nerds.
There are few kids' programs that have really had audiences that span generations, although one you heard right there, we talked about the Muppets. We're having a conversation about TV and about movies that are meant for kids, but that we enjoy watching as adults, and why they bring us a little bit of comfort. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our guest is Michael Newman, who's a media studies professor at UW-Milwaukee, and we're taking your calls now. We've got Mike and Madison on the line. Hey, Mike.
Hi, good afternoon. This is a subject that is very close to my heart. I'm almost 60 years old, but I was brought up on animation. So the medium of animation to me is boundless. I mean, if anybody who's watched Looney Tunes knows that gravity and the laws of physics mean nothing. So it's really fun to, anything is possible inside of animation. And so I seek out animation that particularly where there's some really good storytelling. That's another thing that's wonderful about it. It's a wonderful medium to tell stories that really are touching. So some of my favorites are The Iron Giant. More recently, Moana. It's really amazing storytelling. For something that's just plain old silly, it's Hoodwinked. The animation quality is not very good, but it's still some really fun storytelling, very imaginative.
Mike, thank you for sharing that with us. And Michael Newman, you teach courses on film and television. Here's your opening. What do you want to say about animation?
Well, animation has such a long history, and I think it does do some of these things that Mike was talking about. It can be used in such creative and inventive ways that defy the laws of gravity or physics. It can be fantastical, and it can show us other worlds. I'm thinking like in Coco, the recent Pixar kind of instant classic, The Land of the Dead, and how it comes to life. And you just can't imagine that kind of visual array of skeletons walking and talking done with live action. Or characters, they can change shape, they can perform in just unimaginable ways, like the performance of the genie in Aladdin. I'm thinking of the Robin Williams Aladdin, the older one. And so it's just completely different from live action in the way that the filmmakers have opportunities to show us things that we haven't seen.
Let's take a listen to a little bit of the movie Coco. That is an animated movie from 2017.
Mama Coco, can you hear me? It's Miguel. I saw your papa. Remember? Papa? Please, if you forget him, he'll be gone forever. Here, this was his guitar, right? He used to play it to you? See, there he is. Papa, remember? Papa? Mama Coco, please, don't forget him.
You mentioned how visually stunning this movie is, but it also has these incredible connections about real life, about memory loss, and about family. Why does that movie stand out to you?
I think it's remarkable in several ways. I think it's a remarkable achievement just visually, and I love the songs, and I think the story is beautiful. And also, as a Latino film, set in Mexico, and the performers are all Latino performers, so that's a landmark as well for such a successful, huge kind of blockbuster movie. Another name for children's or kid films would be family films. They're films that are made for families, but they also, like in the case of Coco, have a theme of family unity or togetherness or understanding, and that Coco does this amazing thing with memory, but also with the many generations of the family kind of understanding one another and coming together. So I think that, how touching that is as a story about the kid and his great grandmother and what music does to bring them together. It also you know, offer something to the audience of, you know, connecting them across generations as well.
Yeah. We're talking with Michael Newman, who teaches courses on film and television at UW-Milwaukee. And we're taking your calls to want to bring Patrick in Milwaukee to the conversation. Hi, Patrick.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you for bringing up such a wonderful topic. I, too, really enjoyed Coco. And, yes, it was visually stunning. But another thing that I really took out of it was a similar kind of grand concept from Inside Out. And that was this idea of really the films nowadays that kids are watching. It's amazing how, because of all the different things that they're at their fingertips, that they could take these really big concepts, or in some cases like Coco, potentially a macabre subject, and be able to distill it into something that is, you know, a learning opportunity for young minds. And I think that there is so much that can be packed into a film nowadays, compared to some of the things that maybe we were watching as kids. I also wanted to say that I really enjoyed Soul, which was another very new one. And the last thing that I wanted to say is my girlfriend and I enjoy kids' movies so much to this day. We don't have any kids ourselves, but we have some different nieces and nephews in the family that we get to share some of these new films with. And I personally am the biggest fan of Big Hero 6, and so much so that we named our 105-pound black and white mastiff dog Baymax, for any of the viewers, any of the listeners who know that reference. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Oh, Patrick, thank you so much for sharing so much, for talking about the themes, and also, you know, letting us know about where the name of your dog came from. Michael, have you named anything after a movie?
Not that I can recall. That's not a question I was anticipating.
Just checking. You never
it.
Know.
I support it.
You support it. Great. Let's go ahead and welcome Christine from Platteville then. Hey, Christine.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to go a little retro with the point from Nielsen. It may not be children's focus, but it is. And it has a very, very good message and very enlightening. I also love The Yellow Submarine. We're not even going to talk about that one. But that is, it's very kid-friendly. There is no obscene language in there or anything that would insult anybody. And I enjoyed both of those animations very much.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Christine. And let's hear from Sullivan calling from Viroqua. Hi, Sullivan.
Hi. So today I want to talk a little bit about anime. Anime, I haven't really watched a lot of it yet. I've been watching anime for about a year, and it's always just stood out to me how beautiful some of the animations can be, and they can always portray such an amazing story in such a short amount of time, whether it be 12 episodes, and no matter what kind of genre you like, you can watch pretty much anything from action to romance to kids anime to adults anime. Pretty much everything is there, and I've always just found it so enjoyable to watch anime, talk about it with my friends, and say you find a fan base for an anime. You're going to find somebody who likes that anime. You could talk about that anime for hours with them, and, like, you'll never run out of stuff to talk about.
Sullivan, thank you so much for helping us branch into another piece of animated film and television shows now. We really appreciate your call. Michael Newman, what's your take on anime and how many different kinds of anime a person can watch or read?
Yeah, it's never been a huge thing of my own, so I probably know much less than the caller. but I do love the Japanese movies of Miyazaki, like Spirited Away and Kiki's Delivery Service and the others that I've been watching recently on HBO Max because they're available to stream there. And it's true that they have a really distinctive style. They have a kind of painterly style that's different from certainly than Pixar, but also Disney Animation and Warner Brothers, Looney Tunes kind of stuff. And I think for some of these movies that have such a broad appeal, to think of them as children's films is kind of to do them wrong. They're films sometimes about children or that appeal to people of many ages and backgrounds, but sometimes they're just, you know, beautiful stories that happen to be in the medium of animation.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Michael Newman is a media studies professor at UW-Milwaukee. He teaches courses on film and television. He's also the author of several books, including Video Revolutions on the History of a Medium. And he joined us to talk about movies made for kids that adults also enjoy. And weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow, a record number of women were sworn into Congress earlier this year. Now there are 120 women elected to the U.S. House of Representatives and 24 in the Senate. We're talking with the author of The First, The Inside Story of the Women Who Are Reshaping Congress. Tune into the Ideas Network to be part of that conversation tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is Central Time. There isn't anything more.